Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the 26th video for the Old Testament Survey course. In this section, we will complete the historical books by looking at the book of Esther. Esther is a remarkable story and a beautiful story, but there's a lot more going on than meets the eye. Let's start with some background issues. First, the author of Esther is anonymous. We have no idea and no good guesses who the author might be. But he's a masterful storyteller, using understatement and irony to highlight the point of this story. The location of this history is the Persian Empire. The Persians had conquered the Babylonians and taken over their empire. The story of Esther all took place in the capital city of Susa, but it affected the entire empire, including the Promised Land. The time period covered in the book of Esther is between the first and second return to the Promised Land that was recorded in the book of Ezra. So the book of Esther takes place in the middle of the time period covered in Ezra. We'll look at exact dates and timeline in just a bit. And in terms of the purpose for this book, Esther is much more than just a love story. For one, it explains the reason behind the Jewish Feast of Purim, and this book also brilliantly demonstrates God's faithfulness to his people and his promises. And speaking of God, the book of Esther doesn't. This book is notorious in the Bible because there is no mention of God in the entire book. Some ancient rabbis even question whether it should be in the Bible for that reason. Yes, God is not explicitly mentioned in the book, but I think that God is all over this book. We must look behind the scenes. We must pay attention to the way the author tells the story, and we will see God. Now let's look at the organization of this book. The outline is very simple, using a standard storytelling technique. First, it narrates the problem. A Persian official conspired to kill all the Jews, and he had the power to do so. Hitler was not the first person in history to attempt the extermination of the Jews, not even close. Now, if all the Jews were to die during the book of Esther, then God's promises to Abraham and David would fail. God's plan for the whole world would fail. Do you see the problem? But then the book tells of God's providential solution. God worked it out through unforeseen circumstances and through his people's faithfulness in the circumstances which they were given. We'll go through the plot in more detail in just a bit. But overall, the organization of Esther is fairly straightforward. Now we'll shift to the content of Esther, beginning with some key verses. First is Esther chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, which say, "When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes." This passage introduces the hatred that Haman had for Mordecai and his plan to kill not only Mordecai, but also all of his countrymen, the Jews. Of course, this is the horrible problem that needs to be overcome in this book. Next is Esther 4, verses 12 through 16, which says, "When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: 'Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this?' Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai: 'Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish.'" This passage is important for a few reasons. First, Mordecai expressed confidence that deliverance for the Jews would happen, one way or another. But he also encouraged Esther that she might have been providentially placed in her role for such a strategic time and situation as this. And therefore, she should be faithful to do what is right in her moment of opportunity. And Esther requested a fast, but did not mention prayer. And I think that omission is significant. It's an ironic understatement, and I'll explain this in a little bit. And Esther also committed to do what is right, even at tremendous risk to herself. Next is Esther 6, verses 1 through 10, saying, "That night the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this?" the king asked. "Nothing has been done for him," his attendants answered. The king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows he had erected for him. His attendants answered, "Haman is standing in the court." "Bring him in," the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought to himself, "Who is there that the king would rather honor than me?" So he answered the king, "For the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor.'" "Go at once," the king commanded Haman. "Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended." This passage represents the beginning of the turnaround of the story, when the bad guy starts to lose. And notice how this hinges on so many coincidences. The king could not sleep, and they read to him, and they just happened to read about Mordecai helping the king, and Haman the villain just happened to be there. And the tables were magnificently turned on Haman, and he received the foreshadowing of his eventual catastrophic downfall before Mordecai's people, the Jews. And finally is Esther 7, 1 through 6. I'll just read parts of this passage, which says, "So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and the king again asked, 'Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted.' Then Queen Esther answered, 'If I have found favor with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. This is my petition, and spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation.' King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, 'Who is he? Where is the man who has dared to do such a thing?' Esther said, 'The adversary and enemy is this vile Haman.'" This passage is the climax of the story, where the queen asked the king to spare her life and her people. Haman thought everything was going his way, and he was favored by the king and queen, and his plan to kill all his enemies was about to be fulfilled. But with one question, all of that changed, and the king became furious with Haman and was about to do to him what he had planned to do to the Jews. These key passages summarize the key moments in this entire story and subtly point out the key messages of this book, which we'll come back to before too long. Now, let's work through the plot with a little more detail. As I mentioned in the outline, the story moves from problem to solution. And this book reads like an old-time melodrama. You may have seen one of those exaggerated dramas, and they typically have a cartoonish villain in a black cape where everyone in the audience boos and hisses and throws popcorn when the bad guy comes on the stage. Well, Haman is the despicable villain in this story. And in a melodrama, the crowd cheers when the hero comes on stage. And in this story, both Mordecai and Esther share the role of hero, though, like all biblical history, God is the ultimate hero of every story. And in a typical melodrama, the villain has an evil plot, and it is tense for a while when it looks as if the bad guy will succeed. But at the last minute, the hero comes through, and the villain is punished. Those modern melodramas are following the storyline that we see in the ancient book of Esther. And like a melodrama, when reading Esther, we should despise the villain and cheer for the heroes. And we should rejoice when the good guy wins and the bad guy is foiled again. In the book of Esther, we see the problem in chapters 1 through 3. It starts when Queen Vashti was deposed as queen of the Persian Empire, and Esther eventually was chosen to replace her as queen. Esther was Jewish, but kept her nationality a secret on the advice of her uncle Mordecai. And it turns out that earlier Mordecai had done a service to the king, protecting him from assassination. And then Haman, one of the king's high officials, despised Mordecai because of Haman's prideful insolence. And because Mordecai was Jewish and Haman was an Amalekite, a traditional enemy of the Jews, Haman plotted to have all the Jews exterminated. His hatred for one Jewish man was applied to every Jewish person. He falsely accused the Jews before the king and convinced the king to allow the order for their destruction throughout the entire Persian Empire, which included the Promised Land. And then is the providential solution in chapters 4 through 10. First is Mordecai's request to Esther for her to use her position as queen to help. Then, after fasting and preparation, Esther went to the king at great risk and requested that the king and Haman come to a special banquet she was preparing. Haman was filled with pride and arrogance because he was singled out for special treatment by this request. But in the meantime, Mordecai received his reward from the king, and Haman was humiliated by being the one who was forced to honor Mordecai, whom he despised. Then Esther finally told the king her request in the presence of Haman. She said, "I request that my life be spared." And the king was dumbfounded and enraged. He said, "Who's trying to kill you?" And Esther replied, "This vile Haman." You can just imagine the smug smile being wiped off of Haman's face. And he panicked and begged for mercy from the queen. But the king was furious and had Haman killed in the manner by which Haman had planned to kill Mordecai. And Mordecai was promoted as the king's advisor. And the order to exterminate the Jews was countered with an order that the Jews should defend themselves from all their enemies. And the Jews triumphed and celebrated with the Feast of Purim. So that at the end of the story, not only were the Jews not exterminated, but they were elevated and some were entrusted with key positions in the Persian Empire. And there was much rejoicing. Now, finally, let's go back to the timeline, not only of the book of Esther, but its relationship with the return of the Jews from Babylon to the Promised Land. In 538 BC was the decree by King Cyrus and the first wave of return under Zerubbabel. And the temple construction was begun at that time. Then in 520, work on the temple was renewed after being stopped for over a decade. And in 515, the temple was completed. The king of the Esther story reigned between 486 and 465 BC. We don't know for sure, but the Esther story likely happened nearer to the end of his reign. Then in 458, Ezra returned to the Promised Land with a second wave of Jews going back to Judah. And remember that Ezra went with the king's blessing and tremendous financial support from the Persian Empire. Then in 445 BC was the third return under Nehemiah and the rebuilding of the wall. Remember that Nehemiah returned with the blessing of the Persian king and was appointed governor over Jerusalem. So why do you think Ezra and Nehemiah were given favor by the Persian government? Ezra and Nehemiah received favorable answers to their requests. and this may very well have been influenced by the continued impact of the queenship of Esther and by the favored position of Mordecai the Jew in the Persian government. Remember, Esther is more than just a love story. It impacted generations of Bible history after these events, and it happened through seemingly insignificant coincidences and the faithful obedience of people in the circumstances into which they were put. Mordecai's question was prophetic when he asked, "Who knows but that you've come to royal position for such a time as this?" Well, God had placed her in such a position, in such a time as that, for the long-term influence it would have in history to fulfill God's plans to bring his people back to the promised land. And that brings us to the theological themes of Esther. First is God's poetic justice. Haman got exactly what he deserved, and Mordecai got what Haman wanted. Haman got exactly what he had plotted against Mordecai. God always makes sure justice happens, and in this story, he did it in such a way to make it clear that it was deserved, and the punishment fit the crime. And the next theme is God's behind-the-scenes providence. And this is similar to what we saw in the book of Ruth. God's sovereign faithfulness is shown not in flashy, miraculous ways in this book, but in seemingly insignificant coincidences. Esther just happened to be chosen as queen out of the many other possible candidates. Mordecai just happened to save the king from assassination. The king just happened to have insomnia on that particular night. The servant just happened to read from the one place in the history that mentioned Mordecai's deed. God is not mentioned in Esther, but God is certainly there, working behind the scenes. Again, we can take this to heart in our own lives. You may not always see God evidently working in all your situations and circumstances, but he is working. He is God. Be faithful and trust him, because you never know the long-term effects in history of what God is doing today through your simple acts of obedience in seemingly small matters. So now, let's review the book of Esther. First, we'll review the organization of Esther, and this is problem and solution. And then we'll review the themes of Esther, and they are poetic justice and providence. And now, because Esther is the last of the historical books, let's review the historical books and try to guess their one-word summaries. Like we did with the Torah, I will summarize each book with only one word. But before I do, I want you to consider for yourselves, what word do you think would be most appropriate to summarize each of the historical books? If you need to pause the video for a minute to think it through, feel free. But stop it quick, because I'm about to list these books and their one-word summaries. The first historical book is Joshua, and I've gone with the fairly obvious choice of conquest. And I hope that makes sense, because the book of Joshua is about the people conquering and possessing the land God promised Abraham. Next is Judges, and I've chosen the word apostasy, because this book shows how unfaithful Israel had become during that time. Next is Ruth, and I chose the word faithfulness, because as you should recall, one of the major ideas of that book is covenant faithfulness. Ruth is faithful to her mother-in-law, Boaz to Ruth, but especially the Lord is faithful to his people. And then is Samuel, consisting of the books of 1 and 2 Samuel together. I'm summarizing both books of Samuel with the word monarchy. And I hope this is obvious as well, because the books of Samuel tell about the start of the monarchy and describe the kind of king that God wants. Next is Kings, both 1 and 2 Kings. And I've chosen the word divided. There's a lot going on in Kings, and many words would be appropriate as a summary word for this book. But I chose the word divided to highlight that the unified people of God were divided into two nations, both of which later were conquered because of their sin. Next is the books of Chronicles, which I've summarized with the word temple, because the emphasis of Chronicles is on the temple and Levitical worship. And I've summarized Ezra and Nehemiah together with the word return. And I hope that choice is obvious enough, because both of these books narrate the return of God's people to the promised land. And finally, I've summarized the book of Esther with the word providence, because of God's behind-the-scenes working to save his people. And because we've come to the end of the Old Testament history, let's review the five epics of history. First is the prehistory, which covers the creation, fall, and the spiral downward in sin. Then the patriarchs. God chose one man, Abraham. He gave the promise to bless the world through Abraham, and the promise was protected, even when it looked doubtful. Then is the Exodus and conquest. God rescued Israel from Egypt. He made them into a nation. He gave them the covenant and a revelation of his rule and his name, and they captured the promised land. Then is the monarchy. They requested a king like the other nations, and God gave them a series of kings who led the nation toward scrub or away. The nation was divided, and the northern kingdom was taken over and ceased to exist. And finally is the exile return. The southern kingdom was taken captive to Babylon, but a small remnant returned to the land, and it struggled to be the kingdom of God. And then finally, let's review the Old Testament books and their relationship to history. The books of Genesis through Kings is one continuous narrative, and then Chronicles through Esther retells part of this history and covers later history as well. And then the poetic books and the prophetic books are spread throughout this history, as we'll see in future sections. But what about Israel's future? The prophets will point forward, and from them we will get a glimpse of what God has in store. But we must wait until the New Testament to get the whole picture. Remember, the Old Testament is an unfinished book. But one thing I think we can be sure of at this point is how many of God's promises will fail? None. God's promises do not fail. The Old Testament is a record of human failure. God's people could not keep his covenant with them. But the Old Testament is also a record of God's faithfulness. If the entire human race is a failure because of the sin of Adam and the sin inherited from Adam, what is the hope of humanity? There seems to be a need for a new start, a new creation, a new Adam, a new heart, and a new spirit. We need a Savior. And that is just what is promised in the prophets. And how many of God's promises fail? None. So these promises must have come true or be in process of coming true as we speak. Therefore, we certainly can live in hope and trust in God. Right, this then wraps up the Old Testament historical books and the Old Testament history. In the next section, we'll start to look at the poetic books for a whole new kind of Old Testament goodness. And I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for watching.